Hello and welcome to the timing module for the insulin resistance solution practitioner training. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I'm excited to share this cutting edge information with you. It's a topic that's not talked about enough, and it's a topic that a lot of people don't want to hear about, but it's also very freeing and rewarding because there's no new rules about what to do or what not to do. It's all about when to do everything. So we're going to tie a lot of the other topics we've talked about already, the fitness, the nutrition, the supplements, the sleep, the stress management, and we're going to tie a nice little bow around it and give you some tips that you can share with your clients about how to time all these activities for the optimal results. And as usual, the information that I'm sharing is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified health practitioner. It's not medical advice. And when you're sharing this with your clients, you need to be aware that you're communicating that to them, that this isn't medical advice. It's actually education, and you're helping them to evaluate how to modify their diet and lifestyle so that they get the optimal results in terms of their blood chemistry, and in particular, their insulin sensitivity and blood sugar regulation. And if they're under the care of a doctor, if they're on any medication, it's very, very important that they're in communication with that practitioner, because the types of things that we're doing here are so powerful that it could profoundly change their biochemistry and thus their specific needs for the medication that they're on. So it's important to have their practitioner involved so they can make the necessary adjustments to those medication doses. So let's begin. So before we do jump into timing, let's do a quick review of where we've come through. We've come through a lot of pieces of restoring insulin sensitivity, and you have a lot of tools under your belt. We started with assessments, and there's quite a number of ways to assess, starting with pencil and paper questionnaires, online questionnaires, and then blood work testing, and of course, our trusty little glucose meter, which we want to get everybody using as much as possible because it gives so much information about how to customize the program to each person. We went into nutrition. I recommended starting with a specific set of supplements to help people to improve their sensitivity before going into dietary restrictions, because you're going to get most compliance that way. We talked about stress and the really importance of stress management and the effects of cortisol, which we'll talk a little bit more about in our timing presentation right here. It's really, for me, the most valuable piece is doing the heart math, the quick coherence, things like that. For you, it might be something totally different. Maybe you're a wizard at heart math. Maybe you can teach them some self-reiki that they could do. Whatever it is that you know that you can teach people that they're going to do. And it's important to have a number of techniques under your belt. My personal favorite is the heart math, which is why I teach so much of it. We went into fitness and the importance of burst exercise and the timing of the exercise. We'll go into even more detail today and talk about the growth hormone and the effects that the timing of exercise with food has. And then we talked about sleep and how important it is to get a good night's sleep and the chemistry that happens during the sleep. And now we're ready for timing. After the timing, we'll pull it all together into an implementation plan and teach you how to guide people through a 30-day metabolic reset and then a reintroduction phase after that and a maintenance phase. And then I'm going to teach you how to take this information out into your community in a marketing and community education fashion. You know, before we get fully into the timing again, I just want to reiterate, there are going to be a lot of people who have insulin resistance. They don't even know that they have insulin resistance. You may have insulin resistance and you don't know. So I would really encourage you to apply these principles first to you, to bring yourself into balance, to be a model, to get to experience it firsthand, and then you'll be an amazing teacher and coach. Let's get ourselves centered and calm and ready to receive by doing a little quick coherence, and getting a little practice, doing something that you need to become masterful at for yourself and for guiding your clients.
So let's all sit in our chairs. You can either fold your legs under you, lotus style, or put them flat on the floor. Put one hand over your heart, the other hand over your belly. And then just go ahead and take a few long, slow, deep breaths. And as you breathe, breathe as if you're breathing right into your heart, bathing your heart with clean air, oxygen, fresh, reoxygenated blood. Just allow yourself to feel that. And as you breathe in the next time, activate a feeling, a really deep heart feeling, feeling of love and appreciation. And you might be able to do that by just thinking the thoughts, love and appreciation. Or you might need to reach for some sort of a memory or visualization of a place that you love, a place that brings you joy and peace. Or of a person that you love that brings you joy and peace to be around. And just get that feeling. Go back into that scene or go forward into that scene if it's something that you're imagining and visualizing and scheming towards. And just be there. Actually put yourself there. The beauty of our brain, our nervous system, a magnificent nervous system, is that it can't tell the difference between you faking it and really making it, so to speak, between you remembering in vivid detail or visualizing in vivid detail a scene and actually being there. You can evoke the same wonderful chemistry, the same balance in blood sugar and hormones that you could if you were indeed there. So trick your brain and learn this well so you could teach your clients. Because like I said, it's nothing short of miraculous. HeartMath.org has plenty more details even in the 30-day stress transformation tool that I gave you. Don't gloss over this. Take it seriously. So just pull up that beautiful scene, gazing into a lover's eyes, looking out over a sunset, holding a newborn baby for the first time, stroking a pet as it lays in your lap, filled with unconditional love. I'm going to the beach. So I'm ready to be back with you and share with you some new insights, some more details, help you to take it to the next level, help you to get to the point where you own this material, where you feel so confident in teaching it that it just comes naturally and flows because you've seen the magic of the transformation that it can have. And then just take a couple more deep breaths and then open your eyes and come back into the room ready to learn, ready to grow, ready to have some new skills that you can take into your practices right away. So let's just review those five steps to restoring balance in insulin. Is increase your insulin sensitivity, right? Remember we said we like to increase the sensitivity by introducing some nutrients before we actually change those dietary things that are causing the person to need more insulin. So the second step is then to decrease the insulin need, and that's through eating foods that keep the blood sugar nice and in check and doing some things like exercises and sleep breaks and stress breaks that help to decrease the need for insulin. And then reducing inflammation, a big part of it, and we talked a lot about the allergies, food allergies, and inhalant allergies too, but we mainly focused on food allergies and other things that cause, like autoimmune things that cause an increase in inflammation and how that devastating that is to insulin receptors. And optimizing fat burning and lean muscle mass building. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in terms of growth hormone and balancing growth hormone and timing of your exercise. And then finally, minimizing what I like to call the candy bar eating effect of stress, how cortisol can actually raise your blood sugar as much as eating a candy bar without all the fun. So when you have somebody who's saying, well, I didn't eat anything bad, but my blood sugar went up. What's going on? And you find out that, you know, they were just screaming and raging, or they go through a lot of road rage, or they're going through some really difficult times, stress in their life, that's having the same effect. Only they don't get to have the fun of eating the candy bar. So we've gone through tools and techniques so far that will help them with that. And remember, what we're striving for is to have a normal blood sugar curve. And you can see by the picture, I've shared this one with you several times. On the picture, you see there's a middle of the road one, and there's a low one, and there's a high one, and you want your person ideally to be between the low one and the middle one. Once you get above the midline, you're already heading towards insulin resistance in terms of the numbers. But you'll see that the curves look very similar in all cases, right? That they start out at a baseline. After eating, they peak at a certain point, and then they come back down. Now, one of the variations on this, which is a pathological variation, is that after it comes down, it dips below the line, and that's what we call reactive hypoglycemia. So that's what we're really striving for people. And when they can keep it in that low range and they don't allow their blood sugar to go above 110, max 120, they're decreasing the effect that the blood sugar and the insulin have on those blood vessels. And remember, we talked on our very first module, we talked about how when the blood sugar goes above 120, they're already having the peripheral neuropathy changes, right? You think that peripheral neuropathy is an end state of like 30 years of diabetes, when in fact it's happening 20 to 30 years before they're even diagnosed in some cases, because their blood sugars are going above 120 and there's a little bit more damage. So by the time they get diagnosed, they're having serious problems. And the same thing with the retinopathies, right? The numbers are between 120, 140, but minimally, you know, absolutely above 140, you're getting those retinal changes that are associated with end-stage diabetes. So our goal is to help our patients and clients to keep those numbers nice and tightly controlled, and to learn to do the introspection and the lifestyle monitoring that allows them then to see when it's going astray and remove those factors from their lives, whether it be doing more meditation and yoga and things that keep it down, or heart math that keep the stresses down, or removing certain foods, even some foods that may to other people be perfectly healthy, right? We talked about incidences where people have problems with blueberries. And blueberries are considered a food that help restore insulin sensitivity. But in some people, it causes their blood sugars to go up, and they need to at least temporarily reduce those. So as we go through the review, I want to share with you, once you've taken your client through a process where they've maintained that really nice, steady blood sugars, they haven't gone above 110 for, you know, 3 to 4 weeks, and they're noticing a difference, and their bellies are flatter, and their brains are clearer, and their energy is higher, then what do you do? Do they have to keep them on that strict a diet for the rest of their lives? Well, for some people, yeah. You know, those people with those strong genetic predispositions to diabetes, or that have been there for a long time. And you know what? It's worth it, right? If they can get their blood sugars down and they can get their body working better and they have to eat cardboard, many of them will say, yeah, I will. Others won't. I remember my son saying that to me once. Mom, he said, if I found out that I had some disease and all I could eat was cardboard to keep me from, you know, for having that disease, I would eat the cardboard and I'd be happy with it. And other people say, don't take my food away, I'd rather be dead, like my brother-in-law did, and he's dead because he wasn't willing to change what he put in his mouth. Our jobs as coaches and practitioners is not just to give them the what to do's, but to help them and coach them to make better decisions, to help them get in touch with what's really most important to them. And don't underestimate that. I've given you resources for that. You can create your own based on my resources or based on your own work. Maybe you are working within a system of getting in touch with those goals and values. It's a super important step, and so I just don't want you to take that lightly as you go through this. And as you go through the program with me, you'll see that I really emphasize that as a very important part of the process. And one of my patients said to me, after she'd lost about 50 pounds and she had had cancer, and she was finding that she had a recurrence of the cancer and decided she better do something about it. And she said to me, she started to run by the motto, don't exchange what you want the most for what you want in the moment. And most people just go for what they want in the moment without regard for what it's causing them and how they're sacrificing what they want the most. So make sure you take that time with your people to really help them get in touch with what they want the most so you can help them to bring them back on course when they start to go astray. And we talked before about breaking the vicious cycle of high glycemic carbohydrate addiction. This is really important, and I just can't emphasize this enough. It's why I started with, don't tell them what to eat, just give them these supplements that help to restore the insulin sensitivity. Yeah, we don't want to just put people on supplements and make them think that's the way they fix their lives. But the point is that if you help them to break the addiction, they're going to make better choices. But the cycle is that they eat these high glycemic carbohydrates, which promote the excess insulin secretion. And then over time, with secreting all that extra insulin, those cells adapt to that high level of insulin by turning it off, by not responding anymore, by putting their hands over their ears and saying, no more, that's enough. And then the high insulin is not allowing the sugar to go into the cells, so what happens is it causes it to get stored as fat and then have a rapid drop in the sugar as like, okay, the sugar's too high, the insulin's too high, and then it gets stored in the fat cells, causing a rapid decline, and in some people, hypoglycemia, low sugar, which leads to cortisol or adrenaline to come out and try to bring that sugar back up. It's a survival thing. It's an emergency. We have to bring it up, and that creates the cravings. And so then they go to the high glycemic carbohydrates again, and the whole thing starts all over. So we need to break the cycle, and all the things that we've been learning so far are going to help you break the cycle, and we're going to go a little further, and we're going to talk about the timing and how to put this all together. So remember, our key lifestyle areas to address: nutrition, we talked about that already, stress, exercise, sleep, and we've given you lots of strategies in those areas. And finally, we're going to talk about timing. I cannot overemphasize how important this is. I have had people who have simply done the timing pieces. I had one person who heard me do an overview talk, shared with them the things about timing. She said, I don't have time, I'm moving. I don't have time to do all this fancy food prep and change things much. But she basically started to time her meals, not eat within 3 hours of going to bed, space her meals 4 to 5 hours apart. In 2 months, she dropped 22 pounds without changing much else. So the timing is super critical. Not that I'm advocating that. She went on to join and started following all of it and went on, and now she's down like 75 or 80 pounds and is now off all her medication, hypertension medication, thyroid medication. She never had to go on the blood glucose lowering medication. Her blood sugars range in around 82 to 85, sometimes 78 to 82. She said, I had a high glycemic morning the day I had my cataract surgery. My blood sugar was up to 86. Whereas she had just been to the doctor before she started all this, and her blood sugar was 119, and they said, you're almost diabetic, lady. You're going to have to go on medication. So don't underestimate the value of timing. You don't have to do these in the order that I've presented them. When I do it as a group, I do it in a set order because that's how you have to do it when you have a group. But if you're working one-on-one with somebody, you're going to do a really good consultation and really get to know them and figure out where the best place to start would be. The best place to start is not necessarily the one that's quote-unquote most important to the outcome. It's the one that they're most likely to follow through on, get some results, and then be really excited about continuing. So let's talk about meal timing. Why is meal timing important? Well, meal timing is important because it affects the ratios of hormones and the effects of one hormone on the other in terms of interfering with the mechanisms. And we'll talk about those very specifically. But here are some meal timing rules I'm going to share with you. And then from here, I'm going to go through and share with you why it's important and what the mechanisms are so you understand it. And you can explain it in however much detail you need to explain it for your client or your patient, right? Some of them want to know in gruesome detail. Some of them just say, tell me what to do. But you understand it, you're going to be better able to explain it. So let's look at some of the meal timing guidelines. Number one, no snacking. Why do we have the no snacking? Well, when you eat more frequently, your glucose, your insulin is going to be up all day long. And remember what insulin is. Insulin is a fat storage hormone. It's not a burning hormone. So what does that mean? If a person's snacking all day long, their insulin never goes down to normal. Their growth hormone never gets to peak. And they are basically in fat storage mode all day long. I don't know about you, but I have very few clients who want to be in fat storage mode all day long. And then the only time they have to burn fat would be at night. But then we find that they are eating late at night. They eat right before they go to bed, which causes an insulin spike, which thwarts the growth hormone spike, and we'll show you some charts on that in a little bit. And so they can't have their growth hormone spike, which means they're not going to go into fat burning and repair of lean muscle tissue. One thing that is important, though, as we're looking at spacing the meals out, is that you don't want them getting famished, weak, or jittery in between meals, because that will put them into a stress state, cause the secretion of cortisol and adrenaline, which will cause them to actually do counters. It'll cause their blood sugar to go up because it's an emergency. So no getting famished, but spacing the meals as far apart as possible. And when you see how we present this in the program, you're going to see a model of how you can present it to your own clients. Okay, and we also have it in your menu plan and recipe guide, your menu planner, and that has a whole section on snacking. We have a snack attack strategy that I gave you, and I gave you that as a separate document in the nutrition module. You want to have them avoid eating a high carbohydrate breakfast. If they can eat carbs without it raising their blood sugar, so say they can eat brown rice and quinoa and lentils, and that doesn't raise their blood sugar, great. Don't have them do that in the morning, because when they do it in the morning, it throws off the levels of leptin. And I'll show you a chart in a bit of how that happens. And that when leptin levels get thrown off and it peaks too soon in the day, then they get the cravings at night. So if they are not so sensitive to carbs that they have to avoid them completely, have them do it later in the day. Have them do it for the evening meal and not too close to bedtime. Eating protein within an hour of waking is important for so many people. It helps to promote growth hormone, and it helps to regulate insulin, and also helps with the cortisol levels throughout the day. And then gradually increase the meal spacing. Remember, we're not allowed to let them get famished, weak, or jittery, so if they're used to eating every hour, you don't tell them, okay, now you have to eat every 6 hours. The compliance is going to be low, or if they're one of these people that is very compliant and will listen to everything you say, they are going to get really, really have a hard time between those meals. So you need to just work with it slowly and work with increasing the capacity at each meal. Like the client who had stomach bypass, she can't eat very much at a time. So you might not get that person to go to a six-hour spacing between meals because their stomach physically can't hold enough. But there might be ways to get around that as well, and it's a matter of being creative as you work with people. So let's look at timing and summary of insulin resistance reset protocols. So what's the timing all about anyway? Well, it's a matter of getting the hormones in balance, and there are certain activities that you can share with your clients to help do that. So what are the hormones that are particularly sensitive to timing of activities? And I'm not just talking food. I'm talking food, exercise, and sleep. Hormones are leptin, ghrelin, growth hormone, insulin, melatonin, and cortisol. Okay, and we'll go through all of those in a little bit more detail so you understand the basic mechanism of how they work. The activities that you can control in terms of timing are sleep and awake. When do you sleep? When do you wake up? Being full and hungry, and we'll talk about one of the advantages of being hungry for a little while in terms of inducing growth hormone, and then exercise and rest. And the balance between all these is going to be what's really important in helping them get their sugars under control. When you eat is as important as what you eat. Why? Well, there's a control center in the brain called the hypothalamus. You've all heard of that before. And it controls your response to life. It controls your temperature and your sleep patterns and your response to light and darkness and your hunger and your thirst and exercise and stress. There's all kinds of things that are affected by the hypothalamus. And the when you eat is affects the way that the hypothalamus controls that. So let's take a look at that. One of the things that happens when you aren't paying attention to the timing and when you are getting these hormones out of balance, and some of them are over-secreting and others are under-secreting, is you develop hormone resistance. And we all know about insulin resistance, right? Because that's what this whole course is all about, is insulin resistance. When there's too much insulin and it causes the receptors to basically get burned out and they no longer hear the signal of insulin and we get blood sugar imbalance. But there's also leptin resistance. And leptin resistance is very common. As we'll see, leptin is a hormone that's secreted by your fat cells. And it says, enough. I've had enough food. Let's go into fat burning. We don't need to take in more food. We can just use what we have for the next few hours. Well, people who are overweight say to me, well, why am I overweight then? Because I must have plenty of leptin. It's just secreting all the time because I have a lot of fat cells. Well, leptin resistance. Because you have so much fat in the cells and you've overridden many times, how many of you have never overridden the signal that you're full and you kept eating? We've all done it. And when you do that too much, it causes the hypothalamus, which hears the signal of leptin, to say, oh, you again? Forget it. You don't mean it. Let's just, you know, I'm going to ignore you. You're there all the time. And so it develops the resistance and it doesn't turn off the appetite. But you can even get adrenaline resistance. You know, people who are hooked on their own adrenaline, adrenaline junkies, develop adrenaline resistance. And what that causes is decrease in fat burning. Because when adrenaline gets released, it helps a process called lipolysis or lipolysis. There's different ways to say it. So that's one thing. And then thyroid resistance. We develop thyroid resistance a lot of times as a result of, well, medicating with thyroid. Some people are on really high levels of thyroid for a really long period of time and the cells get resistant. But more important than thyroid itself is cortisol. Cortisol and inflammation, cytokines, they will basically damage the thyroid receptors on your cells and cause your body to become resistant to the signal of thyroid. So inflammation, chronic inflammation, which could be, you know, post-trauma and you ignore it and don't get that under control. Eating a diet that's inflammatory, lots of foods that are inflammatory, eating food allergens. It could be a hidden infection somewhere in the body, whether it's in the gut or in a joint or in the sinuses. And it could be also stress, because cortisol affects the thyroid resistance and so many people are under stress and overproducing cortisol and that affects it. So all of these resistances all come together to affect your blood sugar. Okay, so let's look at leptin. So leptin peaks in the late evening and it's at its lowest point when you wake up. So when leptin peaks, if you don't have leptin resistance, then that the appetite's going to be turned off. So your appetite will be fine between dinner and bedtime because, right, you're not supposed to eat then. But if you don't, if you either have leptin resistance or you've done something to cause that peak earlier in the day, then what happens is you're craving food right after dinner. You have a full dinner, and even though stomach is full, you're still going, I want food, especially sweets. So that happens when leptin gets out of rhythm, and we're going to teach you how to understand leptin so you can help your clients to do that. And then high glycemic carbohydrates early in the day, I mentioned this earlier, they cause leptin to peak earlier. So it may peak earlier, like say before dinner, and then by the time after dinner comes, the levels are going down and the appetite kicks in and the craving for food kicks in. And then if you entertain that appetite and you actually eat right before bed, we'll see on the next few slides that that affects growth hormone. And then you don't have the nice growth hormone surge that happens right after you fall asleep. And that affects fat burning as well. So all of these things affect fat burning, and they affect the levels of insulin and insulin resistance in the cells. So five rules that you can teach your clients, and I didn't come up with these. They are well documented. There's a really good book called Mastering Leptin. It's 400 and something pages long, and it's got hundreds of references on all the stuff that they talk about. And basic rules are, don't ever eat after dinner. Make your dinner is the last food that you eat. Make it, there be at least 3 hours between dinner and bedtime, and at least 12 hours between dinner and breakfast. That'll help your leptin levels. Eat three meals a day, not four, not five, not six. Eat three meals a day. No snacking in between. Their recommendation is 4 to 6 hours between meals. More than 6 hours, maybe not as good, because with more than 6 hours, you might get into the starvation mode. May not happen right away, but chronically having more than 6 hours between meals could cause a problem where you go into starvation mode. So, for example, we'll talk about something called intermittent fasting, where one day a week you're going to go a really long time between your meals. And that's really good as long as it's intermittent. That's why it's called intermittent fasting. But fasting on a regular basis downregulates your metabolism. Why? Because it decreases the level of leptin, because your body's going, ooh, starving, starving, eat, eat, and it creates a problem. So a lot of longer fasts, you have to be really careful coming off a longer fast, and it can be challenging coming off a longer fast because it's just like your body wants food. But if you do intermittent fasting, where one day a week or 2 days a week, not two consecutive days, you fast, you have your clients fast, it's going to affect their insulin levels, it's going to affect insulin sensitivity, and their leptin resistance is going to go way down. And I've had people do this, and it's had phenomenal results. And some people one day a week, some two, and it depends on where they're on their cycle, right? Because if they're in the cycle where they still have a tremendous amount of weight to lose, it's advantageous to do it 2 days a week. But if they're closer to their ideal weight and they're just trying to maintain it, then maybe just one day a week, because it can promote some rapid weight loss. We mentioned this earlier, but this is one of the leptin, mastering leptin rules, is eat a high-protein breakfast. Ideally, eat it within an hour to an hour and a half of getting up in the morning, because that sets everything for the day. If you start the day with carbs, you're going to cause that leptin peak we talked about. If you start it with protein, it helps everything to stay stable. And then reduce overall the amount of carbs eaten. And on this insulin resistance protocols that we've been talking about, that's what we're doing, at least for those 30 days. And then you're monitoring to find out what that person tolerates. I'm not an advocate of everybody needs to be on a low-carbohydrate diet. I personally am on a low-carbohydrate diet because that's what my body needs. And I have a bunch of people who are, and I have other people who can make a smoothie with 8 bananas and lots of greens, and their blood sugar goes up to 96. Do they have to be on a low-carb diet? Maybe not, right? Unless that carb is causing them to have some kind of yeast overgrowth. But that's another story. So that's Mastering Leptin, great book. So let's look at the chart, normal leptin function. When leptin's perceived properly, you're not going to be hungry after dinner, because it goes up, it peaks at around 2 hours after sleep, midnight, right, which is really a great time for it to peak, and then it starts to come down, and then fat burning begins in the middle of the night. If it peaks earlier, and you're still eating when it's peaking, you're going to miss that fat burning, because fat burning can happen in the presence of insulin. Just, you know, keep this in your mind and really share this with your patient. You cannot burn fat when you have high levels above baseline of insulin. It's impossible. It is impossible. So if you have somebody who needs to burn fat, they cannot do it while insulin is in their system. So you need to have this nice rhythm of leptin and insulin happening. So this is what normally happens, and this is what happens when they're off. Their level peaks sooner, and then it's starting to go down after midnight. And then it's not the level of fat burning is going to be much lower, because it's that, you know, that whole thing that happens at around 4 a.m. where it starts, but it really doesn't happen that much because it peaked too soon and it's on the downhill spiral. Okay? So really important to understand this. And then intimately connected with the leptin cycle is the growth hormone cycle. And the growth hormone peaks after intense exercise bursts and stays elevated for 90 minutes. So if you do 30 minutes of cardio, moderate cardio, your growth hormone will stay elevated for 90 minutes, like it peaks right after and then it starts to go down, but it takes 90 minutes. It stays elevated. If you do 30 seconds of intense burst activity, like all out up to the max, you get that same elevation in growth hormone. And actually, some of the studies show that it goes a little higher. And then it comes down and still takes 90 minutes. So if you get people doing 30-second bursts multiple times throughout the day, it's going to put them in fat burning throughout the day, as long as they're not eating within an hour and a half, that hour and a half of either side. So when you really sit down with it, you can time your eating and your exercise bursts such that you maximize the amount of time in fat burning. Now, if you've got somebody you're working with who's skinny as a rail and doesn't want to lose weight, then you can also use this to help them to maintain their weight and gain, actually. It peaks at midnight, assuming you're going to bed at 11 o'clock. It actually peaks about an hour after you go to bed, but studies that I've looked at have shown that if you go to bed past midnight, much past midnight, you don't get as high a peak in the growth hormone. And the growth hormone peaks once every sleep cycle. And we learned last week that we have probably 4 to 5 sleep cycles, depending on the length of them throughout the night. And once in each of those sleep cycles, it peaks. But the biggest one by far is in that first one. So if you have somebody that eats a snack right before they go to bed, they have insulin in their system. Growth hormone doesn't like insulin. They are like the cousins that are at war with each other. They won't play in the same pen. So once the insulin is up, the growth hormone drops down. Same thing with after exercise. If you do this great exercise and then you go get one of those lovely Gatorades and eat that, or gel packs or whatever else they're pushing for you to have energy, you completely stop fat burning and you go into fat storage mode. So that's not good. And the other thing, so it's antagonized by insulin. So you really want to be careful about that timing. It's super, super important. So here's a little picture of the effect of exercise on growth hormone. So the upper curve is a 30-second all-out burst, like a sprint. Or if you're on an exercise bike, just pushing it to the max and shooting it up, or getting it on one of the Stairmasters or something at the gym, and you just push it all out for 30 seconds, and then you go back to the nice, easy pace. There's a number of ways that you can teach people to do burst training, and we talked about those in the module that we did on fitness. But it basically, the more they do it, the more they're going to shoot their growth hormone levels up. But there was an interesting thing that showed that when you did a second sprint 60 minutes after, it didn't do anything to the growth hormone. But if you waited till after it came back down and you waited a couple of hours or an hour and a half and then did another sprint, then it brought the growth hormone up to the same and sometimes even higher levels. And we have a reference list in the program that you can look at if you want to really look at these in more detail. So we talked about the effect of leptin and growth hormone on our whole insulin resistance and belly fat burning and all that, but cortisol is important as well. Cortisol generally peaks at 8 in the morning. So if you do one of those adrenal stress saliva tests, you'll see that the highest level of cortisol is generally in the morning. It is ideally in the morning, although some people have really low levels in the morning and they're people who are in adrenal burnout. It's lowest at midnight. And again, you're going to see if you do these tests on people, that those people who have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep, you're going to see peaks in the cortisol starts to go up, which helps them, makes them not sleep. It doesn't help them not sleep. It's kind of not something they want help with. And then there's a sharp decline between 8 a.m. and noon, and then a gradual decline until evening. And so the reason for that is it the cortisol is there to get us awake, to get all the systems go. And so it's sharp in the morning, and then it settles down, and then it peaks during the day under stressful circumstances. So if you're sitting at your desk stewing at your boss, or you've got a deadline and you can't meet it, or there's a lot of things that cause temporary spikes in cortisol, and it comes back down again. So that's the ideal with cortisol. The cortisol is in a rhythm, and this just is showing you graphically what that rhythm looks like. High in the morning, it goes back down, it comes back up again. Usually starts to rise again at about 4 o'clock. So what happens, and the reason that cortisol is so important with the blood sugar issues, we talked about this last week in our stress piece, was that your cortisol, when it elevates, its job is to raise your blood sugar, because you're running away from a hungry tiger. You need sugar in your blood to fuel your muscles, to get your heart pumping fast. So it's natural for that cortisol to go up when you're under stress. So if you're getting to be under stress a lot during the day, you're going to be having spikes in your insulin, right? You're going to have blood sugar go up, and then you're going to have insulin spikes. And that's going to affect the whole fat burning, fat storage. And the cool part is that when cortisol goes for fuel to burn and turn into sugar, it generally doesn't go for fat storage, unfortunately. It goes for muscle. It goes for gluconeogenesis, breakdown protein stores, because it's quick and easy for it to do. So basically, you can be, if you're not running away from a tiger, you're sitting at your desk stewing, you're sitting there, and your blood sugar goes up because you broke down your thighs, and then insulin goes too high and eventually gets stored back around your waist. So if you want to turn, tell people, people love hearing this, if you want to turn your thighs into belly fat, get stressed out all day. So one of the things you can do to help dissipate that stress was to exercise. So teach them that if they're feeling really stressed out, to run up and down the stairs or do something to actually burn that sugar, because otherwise it's going to sit there and it's going to go on your belly. So people can be just sitting there at their desk adding to their belly fat. It happens all the time. So let's look at protein timing in insulin. Insulin increases protein synthesis. It also increases fat synthesis. So that's what its job is. It's an anabolic hormone. It's an anabolic meaning it stores. It makes things to store. So if the protein's available in the bloodstream and the blood sugar is normal, insulin almost completely stops the process of breaking down muscles for your protein needs. So you get up in the morning and you feed yourself with protein, then your body's not going to try to burn muscle to make sugar. It's got the protein in the bloodstream and it can convert that to sugar. So especially if you're getting stressed, probably if you have a specific time of day that you're the most stressed, have a protein shake. You know, right before you know you're having a meeting with your boss, have a protein shake so that when the cortisol goes to find you more fuel, it's not going to have to go very far and break your muscles down. So if the protein's not available and the glucose is normal, muscle breakdown is stopped partially. But if the blood sugar is high, insulin then stimulates muscle breakdown throughout your body. So let me say that again. If your blood sugar is high, the high level of insulin will stimulate the muscle breakdown throughout your body. Okay? So that's the takeaway. Every time you stimulate insulin production by eating carbohydrates, you need to eat some complete protein with it. Or instead of rebuilding your muscles and tissues, your body will continue to dissemble itself to get that protein. So this is all science. This is not anything that I made up. This is not anything from theory or conjecture. This is all in the science. So leptin, when you have a high glycemic diet and the insulin surges, too much fat from overeating causes excess leptin. We talked about that. The pancreas and the hypothalamus both develop leptin resistance by shutting down the receptors when it's too high. So it basically, it's always reading your gas tank as empty, even when it's full. So if your gas tank always read as empty when you're on the road, you're going to spend a lot of time looking for a gas station to refuel. Same in your body. Increases appetite, decreases metabolism, because we're saying conserve. So the pancreas reduces its insulin in response to rising leptin. So basically, you eat the meal, and the insulin goes up. You've got sugar in your system. The leptin levels are stimulated because you're storing it, and then you basically turn off that. And if the pancreas has become leptin resistant, then it just continues to secrete insulin when normally it would stop doing that. So when you go back to those charts we looked at, that's why it's really important to maintain those rules about leptin so you don't get into trouble that way. So the timing for protein for optimal, protein within an hour of getting up. There are some gurus who say 30 grams of protein within 30 minutes of rising. Actually, that was not necessarily a health guru. That was in the 4-Minute Body by the guy that wrote the four-hour work week, the four-hour body. He did this experiment, and he discovered that people who had 30 grams of protein within 30 minutes of rising tended to burn fat better. it was, it's an experiment from one guy with a group of people, but it's something to keep in mind if you're working with somebody who's having some difficulties, to say, well, give this a try. For just about a week, just do 30 grams of protein within 30 minutes of rising. That means that they're going to have to do some pretty intense stuff like protein powders, and like I've figured out a green smoothie that had, you know, like a pound of kale and a couple of scoops of protein powder, and that had 30 grams of protein. And this is going to keep your leptin, insulin, and cortisol all balanced and in control. So here's a study. A protein-rich breakfast reduced food cravings. It was from the University of Missouri. A researcher found that eating a healthy breakfast, especially one high in protein, increases satiety and reduces hunger throughout the day. In addition, using functional magnetic resonance imaging, the researchers found that eating a protein-rich breakfast reduces the brain's signals controlling food motivation and reward-driven eating behavior. So there's evidence here. This is just one of many studies that I found, and I've got a really long list of the references in a document on your page. Since your cortisol peaks at 8 a.m. and its role is to create new glucose from storage to get you going for the day, if you eat protein, it's going to be used as fuel rather than breaking down your muscle, because that's what cortisol's job is. That when cortisol's high like that, it's looking for protein to break down into glucose. And if you've eaten the protein, then it doesn't use the muscles, it uses the protein in the situation. And that's why eating in the morning, within an hour of getting up, when that cortisol level is its highest, tends to be really effective. Now, there are some people, and a lot of the intermittent fasting research shows that some people do really well with skipping breakfast and just having one meal and doing that one day a week. But when you do it on a regular basis, it can be problematic. But again, you've got to work with your person where they're at. So here's a couple more studies you can look up. Salk Institute found that the daily waxing and waning of thousands of genes in the liver is mostly controlled by food intake and not the circadian clock. So it's not set in time when this happens. It's more related to when you're eating and when you're fasting. So you're either in a fasted state or a fed state. And then there's a researcher called Panda. He did a lot of insulin resistance type studies, found out that the activity of your fat-burning genes is highest when you haven't eaten for a while. And that's why we like to have that 4 to 6 hours between meals. And that's going to stimulate the fat-burning genes as well as the other hormonal things that we talked about. Again, another study, if feeding time determines the activity of a large number of genes completely independent of the circadian clock, when you eat and fast every day, that will have a huge impact on your metabolism. So we want to be in a fasted state, fed state, fasted state, fed state. So these people who are eating because they've been told it's important to do every 2 hours, really do the research and feel, make your own decision about what you feel is right. But the research is really strongly pointing to that is a really poor idea. And I've given you a research paper I wrote, it was about 18 pages, including references to help you make that decision. And again, you have to go by each individual person, like person who has the stomach bypass, it's going to be different. And it's going to be, you may have to work with people slowly and gradually to move them to the meal spacing. But overall, the meal spacing is the best thing. Meal frequency and weight loss. I like to give you studies so that you can look them up yourself, so I've given you a bunch of studies in here. Increased meal frequency does not promote greater weight loss in subjects who were prescribed an 8-week equal caloric energy restricted diet. You'll hear this all the time, right? Eat 6 small meals a day. A lot of really popular people that are writing about blood sugar, you know, they're not looking at the research, I don't think. They're not looking at the science. They're looking at popular stuff. They want you not to get too hungry between meals so you don't trigger cortisol, but there are ways to plan your meals so that you're filled and satiated so you don't trigger that. So let's look at a couple more hormones, and then we'll move on to the summaries. And we won't go through these in excruciating detail because you've got them in documents. So ghrelin, what's ghrelin? Ghrelin is a hormone secreted by your belly, your stomach. The cells in your stomach secrete ghrelin to say, ooh, I'm empty, I'm hungry. And it sends a signal to the brain and says, I'm hungry. When you eat, you suppress ghrelin. When you're hungry, you secrete ghrelin. Very, very simple. Stimulates your appetite. But here's the good part. Most people don't like to be hungry. They think that as soon as they're hungry, they have to eat something. It's like, you know, do you ever have an itch in public and it was in a place you just can't scratch in public? You live with it. You just live with it. You know, you can't satisfy all your desires or urges at the time you have them. Same thing with hunger. So when you're hungry, and you explain this to your patients, especially those that need to lose weight, is that here's the good thing that happens. When you get hungry, you increase the secretion of growth hormone. Growth hormone increases your muscles and decreases your fat. So wouldn't you like that? Doesn't mean to stay in that state for hours, because then you can end up with, you know, way too low blood sugar and it's not going to work real well. But if you just do it for a short period of time, say a half an hour, you say, okay, I'm going to get hungry and I'm going to stay hungry for a half an hour before I eat again. Your body gets trained. And so you can teach this to your clients and patients. It's really important because it is a potent stimulator of growth hormone. And you know, we want more and more growth hormone. People are paying a lot of money to get shot up with growth hormone because it's effective. It's an effective stimulator. Why get shot up with it? Why pay a fortune and have the risks? I did a radio show on that once. You know, it's like, why go through that? Just do it naturally. And this is one of the ways. Just love your hunger. Appreciate the hunger. Make friends with hunger. So let's just review the rules. The rules for managing leptin and insulin: never eat after dinner. Why? Because you have that insulin surge. It affects your growth hormone. It affects your leptin. Don't eat after. Eat only 3 meals a day. When you eat in between, you're in a constant state of fat storage. Allow 5 to 6 hours between meals. I've been saying 4 to 6 just because 4 is more reasonable for people, but really 5 to 6 is the optimal. Okay. Don't eat large meals and eat slowly. And people say to me, well, okay, you want me to go four to six hours between meals, but I'm not supposed to eat large meals? No, you eat to capacity. You don't want to overdo it because overdoing it is problematic. And eating slowly helps you to get the signal that you're full before you're overfull, right? And the overfull feeling just affects the whole system. So you really want to do it slowly and allow the time in between. And the breakfast containing protein, I can't emphasize that enough, and reduce the amount of starchy carbohydrates. And that's not a timing rule per se, but I threw it in there just because it's so important. So all these others are timing rules, right? This is all about timing. It's not just what to do, it's when to do it. So let's review. I'm going to say these enough times that you're going to have them down. Please get them to quit eating 3 hours before bedtime. If you're still eating right up to bedtime, start with doing it yourself. And the more you do it yourself, the better you feel. So this concept of burst and burn before bed, about 2 hours after your last meal and about at least an hour before bed. If you do a 2-minute high-intensity burst, it tends to lower the fasting glucose in the morning. And I've seen it over and over. People in the program, they'd be like, I'm doing all these things and my fasting sugar is still low. I say, try this one. Are you doing this one? No. They do it and boom, blood sugar in the morning is 86. So it happens a lot. Now, if it's somebody that's waking up at 3 in the morning because they were molested as a child at 3 in the morning, that's not necessarily going to help. You're going to have to be working on more of the emotional stuff. But it can help dramatically for people where that's an issue. And then plan fitness bursts 2 hours after each meal. So that'll give you time to have the insulin levels dropping back down. It'll burn whatever sugar's left in your system. It'll cause a growth hormone spike, stimulate fat burning between meals, and it's going to regulate everything really, really well. Extending the time between meals to 5 hours is ideal, 5-6. Consume protein within an hour of waking. We've said it before. Avoid high-carbohydrate breakfasts. You're probably going to hear me in your sleep tonight from saying that. Practice breathing and appreciation before each meal. Why? Because that gets you out of your sympathetic mode and into the parasympathetic. That gets you out of the cortisol mode, which shuts down digestion, and into more of the acetylcholine and other of those nice parasympathetic hormones, which help with memory and satiation and all that, and calmness. And then bed no later than 11 p.m. is the ideal. Midnight at the outset, but the earlier the better, right? So if you've got somebody who's used to going to bed at 2, you're not going to say, okay, starting tomorrow, your bedtime's 11. They're not going to buy it. You're going to have to move it back gradually. And I find 15-minute increments, while it's slow, it works well for people. The other thing I just wanted to mention, just related to leptin, and it's not really related to timing, but it is in a way, you want to get a full 8 hours of sleep if you can. What I discover is that if I don't get enough sleep, then especially if I go to bed really late, I'm missing that growth hormone surge, but I'm also affecting that surge of leptin, and it doesn't turn off my appetite. So the next day after I don't eat and get enough sleep, I am starving. And then on days when I get plenty of sleep, I can go hours without eating.